Hello and welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 57, High Flying Bird, from 2019. I'm Mike Manzi.
I'm Tobin Addington.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And Mike, we are back here. And Tobin, we are back here. But Mike, we are back here for another Cinemakers. We had talked a few weeks ago now on our Matt Stewart's episode about our summer of Cinemakers and how that was. We had a very specific idea of how that was going to go. And then it all began to go downhill when we watched Spider's Web movie for Fede Alvarez.
Yes.
And I messaged you and I was like, can we not do this? And then I texted Nick and Nick was like, thank God, because I watched it twice, hoping that I would have more about it the second time, and no. So that failed, and then this, there were some scheduling issues, snafus, whatever, but we are here. It is in the same year that this movie came out, so I think it's a win all around. Steven Soderbergh back with another experimental film of sorts.
Well, this just came out in February, right? So we're not that far behind.
No, we're not that far. I would say, though, of all of his experimental weirdo things, this is probably my favorite. Not that this is one of my favorite Soderbergh movies, but I think of all the stuff that he has done in a weird way with a unique distribution, with a unique filming style, what have you, I think I like this one more than the other ones, and especially, you know, like Bubble and Full Frontal and all those kind of movies.
Yes, well, I got a girlfriend experience vibe from this, at least, you know, that sort of period of Soderbergh. And yeah, you know, we're here for the first time. He's on Netflix. So, you know, he's jumped on that distribution wagon. You know him, he's always sort of been at the forefront. I'm surprised he wasn't there on day one of Netflix. He's here now, and another iPhone film. This one, I think, looking a little better than Unsane and a little less sort of obvious as like an iPhone film. I didn't think of it as much this time, but I guess in that regard, yeah, he's back in that sort of experimental zone.
Now, it's interesting to say, I completely agree. I think that looks to me on Letterboxd, Joey, like you have it actually a little higher on the Soderbergh list than I do. You have it at number 12.
Well, I love sports.
I have it at 14. So we're right in that same area. But do you not count Logan Lucky as an experiment in that way?
Well, I think it's an experiment in distribution.
Well, Logan Lucky was more of his return out of retirement, right? And that came out as a full feature film in theaters. And
right. But it's also, I mean, that we talked about on that episode about how he had, you know, sold the Netflix rights to fund this and sold the DVD or whatever, blah, 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 to fund that. And like, that was a whole experiment in distribution. I guess I should be more specific in saying experiments in filmmaking rather than distribution, the actual physical craft of making the movie, shooting this all with an iPhone. I like that more than Full Frontal and stuff like that. Because, I mean, Logan Lucky is a master. Not a masterpiece.
Careful, careful.
It's a near masterpiece. It's on par with The Yards.
Oh, Yards. Ooh, yeah. The modern Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But no, this is no Logan Lucky, but it is much more enjoyable, I think, than all the other sort of stuff that he was like, hey, let's do a weird thing.
Well, as someone who isn't, you know, doesn't follow sports as much as you, Joey, but like is, you know, at least now more into sports films and stuff, I was kind of blindsided by this one. Like, I didn't expect it to be more of like, it has more of like a Moneyball vibe than like any other kind of sports movie. Like, they don't think they play a game of basketball in this. Like, there's no sports in this.
I gotta
this.
Say, like, real quick. Only Steven Soderbergh would make a movie about basketball in which there is no basketball. Like, there's people dribbling basketballs and stuff like that, but there is no basketball. I mean, even keeping in mind that this is framed within the NBA lockout, that games are not happening, these are still basketball players, NBA athletes, all these people. Like, there is just so little time spent on a basketball court that aren't, like, speeches. Like, it's just, it is wild.
I thought it was hilarious how, like, the one shot of the pickup game that we get is filmed on an iPhone,
yes.
And it's also in a movie filmed on an iPhone, and I just thought, like, that whole sort of repetition of it was great.
Yeah, you know that he's chuckling along with that, right? Like, that's so his sense of humor. I love that there was not, like, a game that it really wasn't about playing, right? It was about how the players are being played, or who's playing who, I guess, right? Like, all the plays happen sort of off the court, and I think you're totally right. That's such a Soderbergh thing, and the fact that it works as well as it does, it probably, well, maybe not only in his hands, but largely because of what he's able to do.
And I still don't fully understand how Ray plays everyone and comes out on top.
He says at one point, like, there's a whole other game going on behind the game.
Understand and appreciate that, but I don't know what he's actually doing. It's like, it's machinations that we're seeing and that are unseen, and he's pitting the owners against the players, against the agents.
And the players against each other.
Yeah, it is, it's a whole twisted web he's weaving.
I was trying to sort of, you know, straighten it out in my own head too, because I did watch this twice, and it is like you have to keep up with it. It is not going to wait for you know, at any point, right? Like it is, you have to be like quick with this one and like in their zone and stuff. And so what I was sort of parsing together just on like, you know, a very sort of basic level is that during the lockout, he's trying to end it as soon as possible. And he's showing that there's other ways for these players to be making money, right? Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that's what happens is that everyone starts to get sort of worried that they don't need to actually play basketball to make money as basketball stars. And this goes beyond advertising and stuff. Like they could actually start doing games like boxing matches on pay-per-view and things. And so I think by opening up everyone's mind in that direction, it sort of scared them into ending the lockout mm-hmm. in one way. So like that is sort of one grip of it that I had.
You're totally right though, Joey. It's hard to, like I don't know what I don't know all the moves that he makes, like by the end of it. I don't always know who was on whose side at which point and who was being played versus, like, I don't get it fully, like on a sort of plot level, but it doesn't really bother me. You know, it feels almost, you know, like narratively improvisational. And I think that that's like, I'm just sort of going with it because the performances are so good and it's brisk, you know, it's a fast moving, you know, 90 minute movie, like you're in and you're out. And there's always sort of a surprise in every scene. And so, yeah, for whatever reason, and I, at first I chalked it up maybe to just being such a Soderbergh head that I love that so much, but there, you know, like the critical response was pretty good too.
I think the most important thing about the movie is that you need to believe that Ray is the smartest man in the room at all times, and I think it does. Like I think it does that job. I think mm-hmm. that between the performance by Algie, by Andre Holland, Algie from the Nick,
yes.
by the way that Soderbergh and team have written and filmed him and sort of edited his character, I think it's always clear that even when it doesn't look like that, like especially in the very beginning where he's, you know, getting his credit cards declined, that he's out of money, that whatever, he's not able to use the company credit card, that he's always got a handle on what's going on. And he's always playing the game from both sides, and he's always working. It's like a chess. He's playing chess when other people, like when Zachary Quinto, his boss, who I think is great in this movie in his small part, is kind of playing, you know, one or two moves ahead. Like Andre Holland is playing three or four moves ahead. Like he knows exactly how to get from point A to point Z, and then, you know, what to do in between to make sure that this all goes his way. And even if we don't, like, I think improvisational narrative or narratively improvisational or whatever, however you want to call it, whatever you said, Tobin, I think I like that in that we don't necessarily need to know how it's all happening, because the result, for lack of a better word, is jazz, and it's mm-hmm. entertaining and it's engaging, and in the end we know that he wins, and that's kind of all that matters.
Yeah, I really did like this character a lot, and I think Andre Holland is like, he carries this movie so well. Like, you know, like give him anything, like he's such a leading man, like he's so striking and in command of the scenes and stuff. But I really found the character interesting, because I don't feel like he knows at every moment exactly what is going on necessarily. Like he's able to improvise and sort of see from certain angles, and like he's like the best player of this sort of the boardroom game or something, or the inside basketball as opposed to like the court stuff. So I found that very interesting. Like not only is he sort of relying on people to be who they are in order to get them to, you know, do things they don't even realize they're going to do at times, he's also not quite sure this is actually going to work and pulled off. So there's a lot of like tense moments here that wouldn't normally be tense, I feel, like from other perspectives. But from his perspective, it's like, all right, everything is, he's really on the clock to end this lockout.
It's such a good point. The tension is pretty palpable in a sports movie, again, with no sports, right? Like in a sports movie that, as you say, is more of like a boardroom chess match than it is, or in like a social media / boardroom chess match. Another thing I really appreciate about this movie, as with so many Soderbergh movies, is his ability to not condescend to the audience. Like he just drops you in and it is up to you to, you know, stick with it and pay attention and mm-hmm. figure out. And something that's that in his best experiments, he's able to keep the rest of the balls in the air, to mix my metaphors, the rest of the action sort of scene to scene interesting enough that you're not bothered by being outside of the story at first, right? There's enough sort of fun performances and witty dialogue and interesting characters that you're watching that it, I think it goes down easier than some of the experiments where he's dropping you in the middle of bubble and not giving you any sort of clues about who you're dealing with.
And do you think that is a choice by him, like in bubble versus this, to just sort of be like, hey, good luck, or is that his growth as a filmmaker, or is that, like, has he all, I mean, because I guess when you look at a guy who makes Sex, Lies, and Videotape as his first movie, you're like, oh, this guy knows exactly what he's doing. But clearly in the 15 years or whatever since Bubble came out, he's grown as a filmmaker and he's made some of his best movies he's ever made. Do you think that that is a choice that he's always been making, like, here, I'm going to give you little information versus all the information, or enough? Or do you think over time he's sort of realized, hey, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe it's better to do it this way, or it just sort of innate now into him?
I think that it's, I mean, it's hard because I like Bubble a lot more than you do. I like this movie better than Bubble, but I like Bubble a lot more than you do. And it's probably a combination of the two, I would think, right? Like, part of it is as his growth as an artist and his sort of understanding of what an audience will or won't tolerate. That's part of the experiments, right? You try a thing, you see how it does. Does it work or does it not? What part of it does, whatever it doesn't. You retain the things that work well and apply that to things going forward. In the best sense, that's what he does so often. But I think also there is a thing. It's just sort of, you get the sense that he makes movies he would love to see. And he is a smart guy who doesn't want to see dumb movies. He'll see smart, dumb movies, but not dumb, dumb movies. So I think that the part of it's got to be his taste, too.
Yeah, I feel like some of it is like, oh, I want to see this movie done in a different way. Why make this movie like the way it's been done before? It's like, I still want to see this story told again, but, you know, let's try and present it in a different direction. And I'll be honest, like, with this movie, I was treading water the first time I watched it because, like, I felt thrown into the deep end. But there's enough going on otherwise between the look of it and, you know, the speed of it, and I eventually got immersed into the politics of it and all that stuff, so I found my way through it. But the second time I really liked it a lot more and was able to keep up with it. So I started thinking about that too, Joey, is like, I wonder if it's just a case-by-case basis, or if he figured this particular story could be best presented in this style, and it's a style that he's, you know, been able to use before. It's like in his bag of tricks. And then I started thinking even more, you know, we mentioned Logan Lucky, how that has like a fourth act to it and stuff. And then I recalled an interview of him saying how he sort of wants to get away from just classic American structure in general, and, you know, is more interested in foreign film structure and things that they're doing in Asia and Japan and Russia and stuff. And, like, they don't follow necessarily the same rules as American films that everybody is sort of brainwashed to, you know, sort of just expect first, second, and third act type of thing. So I wonder if that has more to do with it, where it's like, I'm trying to create completely new and unique ways of even presenting story. You know, like, I just want to break classic structure.
Which is so perfect in this movie, because that's what Andre Holland's character is trying to do. He's trying to break the rules of the way that the game is played in order to sort of invent a new thing. And then I think what happens at the end is that by doing that, he actually brings the status quo back around, right? He refreshes the status quo as opposed to actually turning them into boxing, which feels to me kind of like Soderbergh. Like, he does this experiment, he tries to sort of break the rules, and then, like, finds his way back to, you know, to a more sort of traditional, revitalized traditional framework of storytelling or distribution or whatever. So that's so cool. I love that seems like a metaphor for him as much as the movie.
You know, the one big difference that I had between the first and the second viewing, Mike, is you're sort of saying that you were treading water and sort of understood a little bit more what he was doing the second time around. I was sort of thrown off by just how many words there are in this movie. Like, it feels like there's more words per minute than not just most Soderbergh movies, but I feel like most movies. Like, I don't say there's not a lot of visual action. There's not a lot of, like, people doing big things. There's a lot of people talking. Like, it's a movie about negotiation. It is sort of like a law movie in that way. It's like lawyers in a courtroom kind of arguing, just instead of a courtroom, it's, you know, the court, or you know, an office or whatever. I did not mean that when I started the sentence. It just sort of wound up there. But anyway, I think because the action has to be delivered vocally through words, via words, that's how it's always going to be. But I remember the first time I watched, like, the night it came out, I paused because I was almost like feeling like exhausted just by, like, how much. And it's not exposition. Like, it's not telling, not showing. Like, he's doing both, but it's just, there's so much, there's so many words. And I was, like, just being pelted by dialogue, by narration, by exposition. I was just like, whew. It didn't feel that way the second time around. Like, I still appreciated, you know, I still recognized how many words there were, but the second time around, I sort of was like, oh, okay, this all flows. I see what's going on here. I know the structure of things. I'm not as overwhelmed by all of this. And I don't know if either of you felt that way.
I definitely noticed the talkiness. I mean, it's written by a playwright, predominantly playwright, Terrell Alvin McCraney, who wrote the play that the movie Moonlight was based on, and then I believe co-wrote the script for Moonlight, which is where he met Andre Holland. And they sort of hatched this idea together. And then Andre Holland was working on The Nick with Soderbergh. Was like, hey, we have this idea. And Soderbergh was like, yes, I'd love to be involved. So he comes from a playwriting background. And this is his first solo credit as a screenwriter. And so it sort of, it makes sense that it would be pretty dialogue heavy.
It's interesting too, though, because like you said, Joey, it doesn't feel like he's telling everything instead of showing. I still, like, in a weird way, like, I'm getting exposition and you're getting, like, he's filling certain people in on certain details. So, like, as you go along and meet different people, you sort of get the full picture, I feel, in a lot of ways. And I think that, and then you get that great scene when he's talking about his cousin finally and everything like that. And I feel like they build character. Like, it's weird in that way. I don't know if that's weird, but in a way, I feel like the scenes are building characters through these conversations a lot. And they're almost like action scenes or like standoffs and duels and stuff like that, but with words and attitudes and people's sort of convictions instead. You know, they're using those as shields and swords instead. Like that sauna room when him and Kyle MacLachlan finally come face to face. That's like, you know, Luke fighting Darth Vader for this movie. So it's an interesting trick how he's able to have such a talky film, you know, for lack of a better term. Not that that's a bad thing or anything, but it also not feeling slow or anything, like feeling like there's action taking place at times.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a play. If anybody out there is listening and has not watched the movie, and don't be put off by it. It doesn't feel like a play. It feels very much like a movie, which is probably, it has as much to do with Soderbergh's interpretation of the script. But they do, you're right, like the set pieces are all in dialogue in the way that the best, I'm going to now say it, court movies are, courtroom dramas.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That really makes sense.
This isn't a bit of an exaggeration, but I think it feels more like a movie than sometimes it looks like a movie, because I think at times, I mean, it is beautiful, because an iPhone can shoot beautiful video, but I feel like sometimes, especially if you know it's shot on an iPhone, you're like, oh, this looks weird. Like, there's times where, like, the screen sort of shakes a little bit. Like, I don't know if it's the image stabilization or whatever on the iPhone, but I feel like the narrative of it, the dialogue of it, everything like that, like you're saying, Tobin, feels like a movie. Like, I wouldn't say be put off by that. I think that there is something visually about this that sort of separates it more from other movies, and not always in a good way or not in a fun way. It's just sort of a, oh, there's something happening here kind of way. It's different visually, I think, than it is narratively.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another change or thing that makes it very much not a play are the little interviews we have with NBA players about their experiences, which I think you mentioned Moneyball earlier. So Moneyball was a movie that Soderbergh was supposed to make, and his version of it was part scripted, but he would have the actual athletes playing themselves, and then part documentary interviews with those people. Like, it sounds totally weird. The script of it is available online. You can find it online. And it's like half, you know, just sort of description and then half an actual script. But he borrowed that idea. He sort of reused that idea here. And I think it works much better for this movie. What did you all think of that? Did you think that worked well in this, to have those interviews interspersed?
I really liked it. Yeah, because we only follow one player really throughout this whole movie. And, you know, he took out like a loan, like a garbage loan that he stuck in and stuff. And I mean, I really appreciated getting these different perspective and points of views from the other teammates and stuff like that, or the other players, the rookies, of, you know, explaining their experience and how they're all different. And it also gave me, you know, it just gave me Soderbergh vibes, because it's like from Aaron Brockovich to Ocean's 11 to like several other movies, like a lot of them start with interviews of people, like sort of head on, face to face, breaking that fourth wall right out of the gate. So it worked for me. I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too. I think we talked about how I like sports. I don't really follow basketball as much as I do other sports. And so I didn't know, like, I didn't recognize these guys by face or whatever. Like, I didn't recognize them right away. So I wasn't sure. Like, it worked for me narratively. Like, I think it worked really well in the movie. But I was sort of trying to figure out for a little bit, like, if they were real players or if they were more sort of characters from this world, because the main character is not a real player. You know what I mean?
Right,
so I was trying to figure that out. And that was more of my own sort of brain just trying to figure out what we're actually seeing here, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think I could have just let it go and just enjoyed it. I did think it worked. I think it also would have been cool in a way, and I don't know that it ever would have happened just because of timing, although this movie only did take 3 weeks to shoot, but I think it would have been cool if you had like a real, like, you know, he was a college player, or maybe even not even in college yet when this movie was shot, but Zion Williamson, who was just, you know, just led Duke to the Final Four, I think, or the Elite Eight at least, and then is going to be drafted number one by the Pelicans in June in next month's draft, or this month's draft, or whenever this episode comes out anyway. It would have been cool if you had somebody like him who is this, you know, the sort of the new modern, or the modern day LeBron James, like the next can't miss prospect, as himself or as a version of himself, as opposed to just an actor. You know what I mean? Like, I think that would have been kind of cool and kind of could have fit in with Soderbergh's vision and style and touch and decisions and whatever. But I also don't mind sort of where we wound up in this world.
Do you have a favorite performance in this movie?
I liked when Bill Duke showed up. I'll just say, like, Bill Duke really brought a lot of weight to this movie. And it's not like he's...
Shout out Mandy, right?
Yeah, shout out Mandy. And it's not even that he's, like, extremely serious in this. He's just... I just get so much respect coming off of his character, you know, like people respect him to the, you know, 100th degree and stuff. So I really loved when he showed up and that he came in and out of the movie a lot.
You know, I don't know how you don't pick Andre Holland just because he's so good here. But
oh, well, that was
given. I'm just sort of assuming that we're gonna leave him off the table.
I should have said, but yeah, besides the lead, yeah.
I got to go Zazie Beetz as his assistant turned, I don't know, ruler of the world by the end of the movie. I don't know what she is by the end of the movie.
Totally.
But she is so good. And what I also like about this movie, and like they don't dwell on it at all, but that she and the main character, whose name I'm not remembering at the moment, have like a sexual relationship, or at least they have sex at one point.
Right.
And it's so understated that it's not a thing. You know what I mean? It's just like a, I don't know if we're in a relationship, I don't know if we just had sex because we were bored or whatever, but when he goes to that court and he's, you know, talking shit on his rival or whatever, his rival shows up, he's like, oh, I can't play, I just had sex and never have sex before a game. We know that he was with her. I just like that there's like this undercurrent of like realism, I guess, or just like this, you know, these story beats, like we don't see them, you know, start to make out and cut away or whatever. Like, we're just, again, Soderbergh is treating us like that we're intelligent enough to realize, not that that's really like a huge logical leap to make, but that it's just another thing that happens in this movie. But anyway, I love her. She's great in this.
Yes, matter of fact. It's like matter of fact in it. Yeah, yeah. She's amazing. Bill Duke was who I was going to say. Mike, as you're saying, the gravitas that he brings, but also the humor. And I just think he's sort of like there's a lot of history with him, both as a actor and this character in this story has so much history. And I just think that's a wonderful, wonderful performance. But, you know, seeing Sonia Sohn from The Wire, seeing Kyle MacLachlan show up, like, as the slimy, like...
Mr. Jackpots.
Yes, yes. He's the Players Association president or the owners,
Yeah, he's Mr. C. He's like the Dark Cooper.
right. And I just, and as you said before, Zachary Quinto, like these actors that I knew showing up in places, you know, in these parts that, like, you get the sense that anybody would do anything for Soderbergh, right? Like, he could sort of have whoever he wants. It really does feel like he gets to sort of just pick and choose. And this movie feels a little bit like, oh, Zachary Quinto's in New York this week? Great, let's throw him in the movie in, you know? But you're right, Joey, the whole thing revolves around, this is a showcase for Andre Holland, and I worry come award season that based on how early in the year it was released and the fact that it was a Netflix movie, that he won't sort of be as recognized for this movie as he should be. But even when I don't understand what he's doing exactly, he is so much fun to watch and so good, as I have gushed on this podcast before with the Nick. But again, I just think he is remarkable in this movie.
I have a feeling he might not get nominated for this only because, like, something might come out in November with him in it that he'll get nominated for. Like, it feels, you know, like, it just feels like his moment is, like, right about to happen.
Another thing that we've sort of noticed recently on a lot of things that we're covering, Mike, is there is the titular High Flying Bird theme song in this movie.
Oh my gosh,
which we have seen a lot on the Tom Tom Club on our Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks episodes, that there are a lot of those movies, but whew.
You know what I don't know if you guys caught it, but it's something that might have felt a little out of place in Logan Lucky, but there's a Game of Thrones reference in this movie as well. Did you catch it? So, like, in Logan Lucky, you know, the inmates want the new books, but in this...
Which I loved, and you guys did not.
No, I liked it. I thought it was funny.
I did not like it, yeah.
And in this, when Andre Holland's talking to Sonia Sohn, they're trying to explain, like, how evil or what a dick this person is. And she mentions, is it Walter Frey?
Mm-hmm.
The guy from the Red Wedding?
Yes.
So I was like, wait a second.
Yeah, I feel like that's just going to be part of our lexicon now, which is kind of weird because that is a very sprawling narrative that, even though I've seen every episode, I probably won't pick up on a lot of them. Like, just in, there's an episode, I think maybe the finale of Better Things, the Pam Adlon show on FX, there's like a very casual Game of Thrones reference. I was like, oh, I guess that's just part of how we write and part of how we speak now, and part of like our reference to things. It's just like picking one of the 500 characters that, you know, grace the screen or the books, and this is just, this is the metaphor for now.
Well, it made me wonder if Soderbergh was such a fan that like he secretly shot second unit on like season 3 or something.
Oh,
we just
that'd
don't
be
know
amazing.
About it, because he was like over at HBO doing The Nick or something, and he's like, you know what,
and that would totally be something he would do, right?
So I looked up Andre Holland on IMDb. He's only going to be, the only thing he's working on right now is a show called, a miniseries called The Eddie, E-D-D-Y. A French club owner deals with the everyday chaos of running a live music venue in the heart of Paris. Drama and musical starring him and Leila Bechti. She is from, I guess she's a French actress, most known for Paris Jatam and A Prophet.
The Eddie is, that's the Damien Chazelle show.
Oh, well, then I'm going to love it. Throughout this movie, there's a runner about the package that he gives to Eric, right? The book. And he's like, you got to read this. This is the Bible, whatever. And it is The Revolt of the Black Athlete. And so there's this whole thing on Refinery 29 from February when this movie came out about how that scene, the final scene, illuminates the entire movie. And about, so there's this whole thing that I will put on our, put in the Discord channel. But there's this whole thing, and I want to read this real quick and just sort of synopsize it, but it's about like this thing that sort of feels like, I was like, what is the significance of this book? Because it seems very important to the narrative, but it's not explained. But there's a whole explanation that I'm going to do a quick synopsis while you guys chat, and I'll recap it.
That was the actual author at the end that he greets in his office when he says, "Doctor, nice to meet you." Like, that's the author of the book that he gave away. I just felt like, you know, he referred to that thing as the Bible. So when you find out what it was, I figured like this was all of the insight that he got to pull off what he did. You know, like everything he learned from this book. And at the end, he was like meeting the man who wrote it. And so it seemed like a journey for him sort of became complete in that sense, too. And I love the line he gives to Zachary Quinto, too, where he's like, "Get up because you're sitting in my chair." Yeah, yeah. Like that, like it all just felt like, all right, like his plan was pulled off, and like that last moment was like proof, sort of the payoff.
Yeah, it was interesting that he's so bold so often, right? Like he'll just drop that at the end and not explain it, and like trust that either you will know or you will go look up and see, you know, that this is this, you know, this Harry Edwards book, and you know, like dig into what it has to say about sports and race and society and everything. And so it's, yeah, I love that about Soderbergh. I love, and even when it can be maddening, it's really exciting to see a filmmaker who trusts us so much.
And that's something we didn't really touch on that is very predominant. This film is a very predominantly black film. The major players, actors, and story all revolve around them. And so, you know, even today, like, it's kind of still kind of rare in a sense when you have, like, the full black cast and stuff. But here, it was very interesting. It was very called for. And I don't know, I just thought it was very respectful in that manner.
And so that is kind of the key to all of this. And it's something, it's the kind of stuff that we've been talking about the entire episode, that what you guys were just talking about there. But the book is about a treatise on how the collective voices and concerted actions of black athletes could evoke institutional change. And so it followed the 1968 Summer Olympics. And that's the, you know, even if you don't know what that is, that, you know the iconic image of the two athletes raising their fists, black power, on the podium. And so it's about how even just very few athletes can make concerted change if they're united. And it's sort of in a world in which Colin Kaepernick is doing everything he can. You know, he sort of threw his career away to sort of not intentionally, but it wound up being that way, in service of the greater good. Like, how do you tell a story in which athletes can have a say? And it's not really a sports movie, but it's about the sports system. And it's about how you're able to sort of take ownership of your career and your image and your abilities, and not make these fat cat owners even wealthier while you get, you know, shunned out of the league, as Andre Holland's, his character's brother in this movie, was for being gay, right? Like, you're able to sort of take ownership of who you are and sort of break free of the hold that these owners have on you. And it's, you know, greater allegories there, I'm sure. And I'm not going to go into this because I don't have the knowledge or the experience, but other people have made, you know, sort of slavery-ish, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like ownership and everything. All of that. And like, how do you regain control of, I talk about a lot in this movie, about your image and sort of your name and your brand
and your body.
Yeah, what you are and are not allowed or able to do. So even though the movie doesn't explicitly, you know, lay out what that book, the real significance of the book is, the movie tells that significance throughout the entire narrative.
Right, exactly. That's a great way to put it. It's like it's sort of like he's underlining the thesis that he's just proven in the story, right? Like he's just sort of explained in the story, which is why it feels so kind of bold that it's not, you say it at the beginning and then we all reference it throughout the course of the movie. Like there's much more traditional ways to incorporate that into your story. Again, this is just bold enough to say, okay, here's the story, and then underline it with this sort of, by putting this book down at the end of it that has been there the whole time, but sort of wrapped up, you know? So, yeah, that's totally cool.
I don't know if I have a lot more to say about this movie. Oh, wait, no, didn't we talk about, was Unseen? Unseen was just an iPhone movie. That was not a Netflix movie. That was theaters and stuff, right? Because there was a quote that I pulled. I'd been in conversations with Netflix during Unseen, and when I ended up going in a different way, I said, look, I have this other thing. I'll make sure you get your eyes on it early. When it was basically finished, I brought it to them, and I said, great, we'd like to buy it. It felt like the kind of the film it is, the best way to maximize eyeballs. It's got a better shot of finding all the people who will like it. Otherwise, it's a slow-rolling platform release, which are expensive, and you're bound by where the big art house theaters are. You can't just go anywhere. I just felt I'd rather have it drop and have everyone be able to see it. And this was the movie, if you remember, that not only did it take 3 weeks to shoot, but after he finished it, 3 hours later, he had a rough cut. So I can see, you know, when you're in that kind of mindset as Steven Soderbergh, you could be like, well, I have a movie that's done. We could put it on Netflix, like, you know, not it's this way, but like tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like, let's just get it out there. So I can totally see why you don't want to go through this like, oh, well, like if you're in New York and LA and near the Arclight or near, you know, the ISC Center or whatever, and like you could go to these one theaters for 1 week or just like on Netflix and like it doesn't have the flair, the pomp and circumstance of it all. But everyone sees it on a Friday in February when there's nothing else going on.
Yeah, you're going to reach all the people who are going to go to the AMC, right? But this will never get shown at the AMC. Like, that's right. But so it's right, the same audience right. as Netflix. And like, that's so smart. It's like, it's those same people that wouldn't go to the art house in Manhattan, plus the people who would go to the art house. Like, everybody's watching Netflix. So you could, yeah, you've got a much better odds of people finding your movie that way.
Well, and interesting too is he must have had some kind of a good experience with this, because much earlier in the process, in terms of production and post-production of his next movie, The Laundromat with Meryl Streep, this is the Panama Papers movie that's coming out this fall, that he like went with Netflix to finance and release that movie kind of from the beginning, right? Like, so it's a much more, and this is like awards movie. It's, you know, it's got Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas in it. Like, it's a big, you know, it's like a big play.
Like, now that Netflix movies are winning Oscars, right? Like, what's the difference?
So the way I think of it a little bit is that this, again, shows my sort of Soderbergh head quality. The boldness or the vision of distribution companies and the infrastructure of new kinds of distribution are finally catching up with where he's been trying to be for a long time. You know, as a person who back all the way back at Bubble, you know, was trying to find ways to release movies on DVD and in the theater the same day and all that kind of stuff. It feels like that the world's kind of catching up with him.
It's just a matter of whether or not, you know, Netflix wants to embrace him and, you know, champion him, because the world has caught up to him and how he wants to distribute things. But, you know, Mike, you're saying that it's right, the Netflix movies are winning Oscars, but it feels like, you know, the Netflix distribution and release schedule is so muddied that it needs to, they sort of need to either put it on the home screen, like, you know, we just did a couple weeks ago for Zach Attack, for the Zac Efron podcast I do with Joe too. Like, when you open Netflix, the Ted Bundy movie was just right there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't remember back in February if this was right there, but it's also a matter of down the line, if Netflix really believes in this and thinks that, you know, Andre Holland or Soderbergh or the screenwriter or whoever have a shot at winning an Oscar, they can take this movie and put it on their back and sort of champion it to the world once again. But I also feel like with The Irishman coming out, that's going to be a Netflix thing. They're sort of going to put all their eggs in that basket. You know what I mean? So the pros and cons of an unconventional, I guess, or a conventional this year, conventional in 2019 release schedule.
The best thing about it is it's always going to be there if you want it, right? Like, it's, you know, right, it's never going to be down. You'll always be able to search for it.
Yeah. Tobin, you have anything else to say about High Flying Bird before we close up shop on this episode of Cinemakers and then, I don't know, maybe come back in 5 or 6 months or 7 months or whenever The Laundromat is out on Blu-ray?
Only one thing to say, which is that as I'm looking through the credits, you know, the looking for sort of new names and stuff, I see this music by David Wilder Savage, which just sounds so much like a pseudonym. And I thought, oh my God, did Soderbergh like compose the music for this movie too? And then I find a lot of reports that it's a pseudonym used by Thomas Newman, who's a pretty famous composer. Wall-E, Skyfall, Shawshank. He did music for Bridge of Spies, speaking of your buddy Tom. And then he's done Soderbergh movies too. He did Side Effects, The Good German, and Aaron Brockovich. He's nominated for 14 Oscars, okay? So like the guys, he's like a, you know, he's one of the big heavy hitters. But for whatever reason, this movie and Unsane, both he used a pseudonym for. And I don't know why.
I know why, because him and Soderbergh became close friends, and he's like, you know what I do sometimes? I edit my own films under a pseudonym, or I write them under a pseudonym. He's like, hey, that's pretty cool. I'm gonna do that.
It does totally feel that way. Like, it's just part of the joke of the things, you know? So like, maybe his iPhone movies will always have David Wilder Savage as the as the credited writer.
Dude, that's not a bad call. Maybe he wanted to sort of like differentiate himself a little bit and be like, yeah, these are my iPhone movies.
My last note was, this is another little bit of trivia, is that Andre Holland suggested this story to Steven Soderbergh. So I don't know if he was in touch with the screenwriter or not, but this was at some point his idea or his germ of a story. And so, cool.
And he's credited as an executive producer as well. Yeah.
Mike, what about you? Any other last thoughts about High Flying Bird?
I guess just about the way it was shot. Like, I wanted to mention earlier when you were talking about it, Joey, like, I do agree with you. There are some limitations shooting with an iPhone. However, I feel like there's way less limitations than, say, when they converted to digital in the first place, or when you're shooting, like, TV movies and things. Like, I really feel like the iPhone holds up like really well in its infancy here, being used for feature films and stuff. And because, like, if this is the third one I've seen now, two Soderbergh that feel completely different, and then Tangerine, which is like balls to the wall super different than this movie. But I think, like, it's, you know, I think it's got a bright future, and I wouldn't be surprised if Soderbergh maybe mixed like iPhone with other digital cameras with film, and, you know, and it's just sort of like, put a red camera here, put an iPhone there. But I don't know, I just think like the iPhone, I'm cool with it. It's here to stay. There's very few shots that feel like they're the only type of shot you could get with an iPhone. Yeah, I think like there are a few limitations now, but I could really see it being something people use a lot, like not just Soderbergh, but I think like people will adopt the iPhone and start shooting it like in general down the line.
And there are other, I don't know if there's side effects or conscious decisions that are either linked to using the iPhone or not, but there's like a lot of natural light in this movie. Like, the movie feels dark at points. Like, sort of, I guess it's in that way Game of Thrones-y. Hey, it's back in our conversation again. But how, as that show went on, they started just using more natural light and things were darker. But like, the shots of Zachary Quinto's office or whatever, where there might be other light, I don't know, but it feels like we're just using the light that's coming in through the office windows and just shooting there because the iPhone is able to adapt. And maybe it can adapt better than a camera. Maybe it doesn't adapt as well, and that's why it looks darker. I don't know. But it's something that I definitely noticed here, that it was going for that more on-the-fly, all-natural look, that it felt like there was more natural light. There wasn't as, it wasn't as much of a movie. And again, I guess that goes back to our conversation earlier about how it feels like a movie but doesn't necessarily look like a movie. But you know, I agree with you, Mike. I think it's here to stay, and I'm on board.
So that's all I got.
Cool. Well, Tobin, thank you so much for, I mean, not that we have to thank you for being our guest, because you're not our guest, you're our co-host here, but thank you for coming back and doing High Flying Bird with us. You have The Contender still going strong. You were doing that when we were doing the regular run of Cinemakers, I believe.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, why don't you talk a little bit, because people are tired of hearing me and Mike talk, I think, but why don't you tell people a little bit more about The Contenders and what movies you've covered lately with your sister, Aislinn?
Yes, good. So thank you. My sister and I have a podcast called The Contenders about movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. So we're looking at movies by and about fearless women, and we sort of go all over the map in terms of what we cover. So, you know, we do recent movies like Captain Marvel. We go back a while. We did a great episode on The Hours. We did Thelma and Louise. Our last two, as of our recording of this, we did Barbed Wire, which is, I hope, a fun episode to listen to. Not a great movie to watch. We should have left that for the folks over at Real Bad. And then we did Dumplin', another Netflix movie with Jennifer Aniston, which is a delightful little movie. So yeah, so we have a good time, and you should come check us out.
Thelma and Louise just came up in conversation when we were recording our Rain Man episode of Cruise Club, because we were talking about Dustin Hoffman being nominated for Best Actor and Tom Cruise not being nominated, but maybe could have or should have been. And that led to a line of questioning down the path of like, well, have there been multiple actors nominated for lead actor? And I think maybe the most recent time in the best act, like two, not supporting, because supporting was just in The Favorite, but I think maybe the last time or one of the last times, one of the very few times that both lead actors or lead actresses in a film have been nominated was in Thelma and Louise. So they were both nominated there. It only happened like four or five times, I think.
I mean, it makes sense. If you're going to do it for a movie, that's one to do it. Yeah.
Sure, of course. But yeah, so check out The Contenders, check out The Tom Tom Club. So The Contenders is every other Tuesday. Tom Tom Club, Tom Cruise, Tom Hanks alternate every Friday.
Fridays are for fun.
Mike's got Third Time's a Charm. There's lots of shows. We've got 25 shows now that you can go check out at cageclub.me. So just go check out. There's new episodes just about every weekday. So find the movie you like, listen to that. There's music ones, there's nostalgia ones, there's comic book ones. Whatever you're into, as long as it's pop culture-y, we probably have you covered. But go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, cinemakers@cageclub.me. Check out our Patreon and Threadless shops, pages, whatever, at cageclub.me. And come back some point later this year for probably a Karin Kusama series with the aforementioned Island Addington. Who knows when that'll be, but that is the next one lined up at some point.
I did not know that. I am here. I'm going to listen to every episode twice.
There you go. Surprise, surprise. But there are 57 episodes now, Cinemaker, so you've got lots of episodes to talk about or to listen to. Steven Soderbergh, Christopher Nolan,
Matt Stewart's,
Amy Heckerling, Fede Alvarez, the RKSS Collective. All of their movies have been covered except for Spider's Web. But 57 episodes, go check them out at cageclub.me and wherever you get podcasts. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And we'll be back at some point for Cinemakers for Karin Kusama right here on Cinemakers.
There's a high flying bird flying way up in the sky. And I wonder if she looks down as she goes on by. Well, she's flying so free and easy in the sky. Lord, look at me here. I'm rooted like a tree.